being held at El Paseo, room 120 in San Jose on September 4th, 1992. Tonight's speaker is Steve L. from Monterey with a 10-minute speaker of Deborah A. The original recording and its copy are available at Saturday Night Live Tape Library. In accordance with Tradition 11 and Step 12 of AA, please do not break the anonymity of the speaker or anyone else in AA at the public level, and please do not play this tape for commercial use. When this side is over, please turn over tape. Thank you.
I'm kind of nervous. I don't know why. But anyway, I think it's probably fear. And anyway, I'm just going to share my experience with you as quickly as I can here. I came into the program when I was 24, and I drank from the time I was 13 until that time when I stopped at 24. I've been in the program since then, in and out. And I never really worked the steps until... I worked at the best of my ability, which was pretty much randomly. I did a fourth step after about 2-3 years. Because I didn't really think that I needed to do the steps. And I don't recommend that to anyone, because they really didn't get what this program has, which is a new life. But I chose that was my way to do things. And that's what I had to do. I guess, what I want to talk about is what qualifies me to be an alcoholic is that when I drank, it was unpredictable how much I would drink. And sometimes I would control my drinking, and then other times I'd be totally out of control. And when I was out of control, I usually got very sick, and I always had a blackout when I was in that condition. My drinking really affected me mentally and emotionally, I would say, more than it did physically, in the sense that by the time I got here, I still had a job, but I wasn't functioning very well mentally. I had a decent job, but, I had an attitude that was pretty much, one that was based on thinking only about myself, and I really believed that everybody was out to get me, truly and literally. And when I came here, it was because I went into the program of Al-Anon, and I decided to come to AA to check out the meeting for somebody else. And I realized as I was here checking out the meeting and I found out how great this program was for somebody else, I continued to go to Al-Anon and occasionally drop in on an AA meeting. And over 2 years, I realized that I had a problem. Now, before I had actually gone to an AA meeting, I'd also gone to the library and checked out every book that I could possibly check out on alcoholism. This is how crazy I was. My way of checking out a life was to read tons of books. I would read so much that my eyes were bloodshot. And so I realized after 2 years I was an alcoholic, and I was absolutely devastated. I really didn't want to be an alcoholic, and I figured that as long as I didn't think I was an alcoholic, I wasn't one. Never mind the fact that all the circumstances in my life pointed to the fact that I couldn't handle alcohol. I did a lot of justification and rationalization that I wasn't an alcoholic even after I came into the program, and that's why I continued to refuse to work the steps. That's why I continued to work the program in the way that I saw fit, not in the way that anyone else was suggesting, not in the way that, the program has been designed, which is we're working the steps and recovering from our past, from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. When I came here, I was so sick that I actually believed that if I stopped drinking that I was fine, I was cured. And I continued to live like that for probably another 5 years. At 5 years of sobriety, I checked myself into a treatment program because I couldn't walk, I couldn't talk, I couldn't eat, I couldn't sleep. I was clinically depressed and I didn't know it. I thought that what was happening was that I couldn't take the stress of my job, my marriage had fallen apart, a whole series of events had happened, and the truth of the matter is that for 5 years I continued to operate like an alcoholic without putting a drink in your body. I refused to do anything different other than to show up at a meeting and say, you know what, all of you people, every one of you, that's something I don't want. But I kept coming here. It's like... This doesn't make any sense, but I kept coming here because it was all I could do to let you chip away, you know, at my fear of you, my fear of myself. You know, and when we talk about this program, it's a program of progress and not perfection. You know, when we make a mistake, it doesn't mean I have to go out and drink and lose over it. It means I'm going to suffer for it. And maybe some other people are going to suffer, depending on what I do. But, you know, we got a program, and one of the things that I didn't even get was, like, I had this big book, and, you know, I decided I never needed to read it. I mean, I was one of those chronic people that decided if, like, my belief system was such, well, if I just show up and look like I'm doing the program, then maybe I'll get it. You know, like, maybe I'll somehow, like, my problems will go away. You know, I'll feel better. It's like if I go and have a drink, I'll feel better. You know, and it's like if I don't do anything but go to the meeting, something will change for me. You know, never mind the fact that I'm going home and abusing whoever it is I happen to live with, whether it be roommate or relationship. You're making a difference. I finally picked up the book when I was in the treatment program, and at 5 years of sobriety, and kept saying to me, are you sure you have 5 years of sobriety? And my response was, if you ask me that question one more time, I'm going to kill you. The truth of the matter is that no, I didn't have 5 years of sobriety. I admitted that last year, and I have 2 years clean, you know, this coming December, God willing. But, you know, it's like, The only experience I can share with you is that because of my own unwillingness, okay, and I believe, you know, the fog was lifted to the extent that I allowed the fog to be lifted. We got a choice. You know, we can look at the stuff in our life and deal with it or not. And it says, I just want to read something out of the book here, and it says, burn an idea into the consciousness of every man that he can get well regardless of anyone. The only condition, and this is the part that I didn't understand and didn't get and didn't want to get, the only condition is that he trusts in God and he clean house. You know, I can handle maybe one of those, maybe on a good day, but not two. Not trusting God and clean house. I mean, that's a big order, right? It's like, well, hey, I don't want to trust in God. That means I can't trust in my own thinking, and that maybe I got all the answers. Maybe that going to the bar isn't such a good idea for me because last time I went there, you know, I ended up in a blackout, in a depression, you know, didn't know what was going on. I mean, I never knew what was going on. And, you know, then I got to clean house. That means I got to do something. Well, the steps means doing something. And, you know, I'm not kidding. I sat in this program for all these years and said to myself, well, you know, I did the steps. And what steps did I do? I did the steps I wanted to do. Literally, I looked up here and I said, you know, okay, I did step one. I shared this before and I'm going to share it again. This is my story. I said, I admit I'm an alcoholic, but my life really isn't unmanageable. Okay, but I did admit I'm an alcoholic. Okay. Came to believe the power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I thought, I do believe the power than ourselves, power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity, but I'm not insane. So I did that step, you know, as much as I needed to do it. Okay, made a decision to turn our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. And I thought, well, yeah, I have faith in God, you know, and I do understand that I have faith in God. That's it. You know, I made a decision, it's done with, so what? And made a searching and fearless and well inventory of ourselves. For about 2-3 years, I swear to you, I thought, inventory of ourselves. And I thought, you know, I don't know what you're talking about. I mean, I really, really don't. And my sponsor kept saying, Deborah, do you foresee? And I kept thinking, I don't know what she's talking about. And she said, just start writing. I'm like, writing what? What do you write? You know, and never occurred to me, and I don't know if my sponsor told me this, I still don't know to this day if she told me to read the book or what she told me. I probably didn't hear it. And then I said, you know, admit to God to ourselves, knowing him the exact age of our lungs. And I said to myself, exact age of our lungs. Okay, well, I think, you know, if I had some wrongs to admit, I would admit them. I would, you know, I really would, but I didn't have any to admit. So, you know, I was done with that step. You know, just, I mean, all down the line, hey, did anybody relate? You know, and I said, when I was ready to have God remove all these defects of character, I didn't have any. I had no defects of character. I swear. I mean, I sat down with my sponsor one day, and this was about a year and a half ago, right before I had this breakdown, I'm like, defects of character, I finally get what that means. You know, yeah, I've got some defects. And for all this time, I mean, when I first was doing these steps, it was like, well, I don't have any defects of character, so, you know, I guess we're entirely ready. I'm ready, but I don't have any defects, so I can't have anything removed. If I didn't have to do steps on them, I didn't have to ask them. And he said, why not? I had no relations, you know. So I didn't make any amends. And, made recommends. So I didn't do step 9. Step 10, continue to take personal inventory. I really didn't get. That was kind of like, you know, the defects of character. It was like, personal inventory, when we were wrong, it was like, I can get that I'm wrong to myself. You know, I don't have to meet anybody else. And thoughts of prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact as we understood him, praying only for knowledge as well for us and power to carry that out. That was like, that would be nice if I could remember to do that. You know, I would do it if I could remember, but you know, I'm too busy. And having a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, you know, we tried to carry the message to alcoholics and to practice these principles and all the first. And that one I had no clue. I mean, I said to myself, spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. It was like, what spiritual awakening are they talking about? You know, I mean, literally, I was thinking this to myself, consciously. What spiritual awakening? And I would get moments. I don't want to mislead you into thinking I wouldn't have stuck around here. You know, but I had moments where I became very aware that there was a God in my life. And see, I came from such a background growing up. I got the shit beat out of me. I was molested. I had no ability to trust anyone. Didn't trust anyone. Didn't trust women. Didn't trust men. I hated everyone. And, you know, it just left me no option. So, of course, I wasn't going to do the steps. But when I got the step 12, I can remember I had always read these steps up here, and I come to meetings and I would think to myself, we tried to carry the answer to alcoholics and practice principles in all our affairs, and I kept thinking to myself, carry the message, yeah, I know, I kind of get an idea there. And practice principles in all our affairs, that was like way over my head. There was nothing to practice, you know, nothing. It was like, you know, are they talking about, I used to say to my affairs, are they talking about work or home or, somebody help me out here. I mean, I really just didn't have a clue. And all I want to tell you is burn the idea into the consciousness of every man. He can get well regardless of anyone. I'm living testimonial and proof. I stand here somewhat sane today. I can at least admit where I was at, you know. The only condition is you trust in God and clean house. You know, and I don't know about you, but trusting God takes a lot out of me. You know, it means I got to give up some things, some pride, you know, some fear. I got to trust some people. Maybe they can show me how to trust in God and clean house. I got to do some work. You know, I'm not talking about home, you know, work at home. I'm talking about cleaning my insides out. You know, getting rid of that hatred towards other people because they don't do things my way. And I just, you know, I guess what I want to pass on to you tonight is that, you know, there's a lot of work that we have to do to stay here, and there's a lot of rewards. You know, I wouldn't have what I have today standing up here, whether you see it or know it or not. I wouldn't have what I have today if it wasn't for each and every one of you who I've heard share, who I've seen go through bad times and good times. You know, and this program, we don't have to do it alone, you know? I mean, I don't think any of us have to do it alone, and that's the message. You know, we have each other, we have God, you know, we have this program, and I don't know about you, but I really can see now where my alcoholism led me, and I don't think God reveals that to us until we're ready to see it. You know, we get the information when we need to get it, and you know, I would say for the newcomer and even for people who aren't newcomers, you know, I used to sit here in the meeting and say, I wish I was a newcomer so somebody would talk to me differently. You know, because it was like I had too much pride. You know, I couldn't admit I was hurting bad. And so all I can say to you is, you know, we're here to carry the message to each other. And believe me, nobody else is going to carry to us. We got to do it for each other. And I'm truly grateful for that. And thanks for letting me share.
I'm Steve. and I'm an alcoholic. You know, I was worried about having a big crowd up here, and I'm not much on speaking on crowds. But there's not that many people who paid attention to me anyway. And when that happens, I usually find out it's because I need to hear it more than anybody else. You know, some people are sicker than others. When I came to the program back in October of 81, I got clean and sober in Hawaii, and I was about the only place that I could do this. And I understood the people that became my home group. They talked my language, unfortunately, because of the gentle souls in here and a policy about language. I can't tell you verbatim what they had to tell me. So, I talk slow. And if you find anything humorous about what I've gone through in my life, and you want to laugh, go right ahead. You want to cry, that's good too. Because we're here to celebrate life. Not just recovery from alcoholism, but celebrating life on the spiritual road, on a God of our understanding. And before I begin, I was also told that my rear end would be in trouble if I didn't mention that certain individuals in the Monterey Fellowship wanted to say hello to certain individuals up here, especially to this group. And if I don't get the certain names right, that's too bad, because I can't remember everybody and who they wanted to say. Anyway, the one thing when I first came in the program that I remembered and I could relate to was that I'm not an alcoholic. You see, alcoholism, drug addiction is a white man's disease. Me, I'm a Hawaiian national, predominantly Filipino, trace of Japanese, and then there's a Hawaiian and Samoan connection through my mother's side of the family. So I didn't belong here. I left Hawaii as a very young kid. That was before it even became a state. I never came to the United States until 1962. As a kid growing up in Hawaii, I didn't know there was something different between me and the rest of you. I knew from my family I was set apart and I was getting special training, because that is our way and it is the way of our people. But I didn't know that being brown or being black or being white set you apart. And I learned that the hard way growing up in a place called Berlin. And it was at the hands of children from the American soldiers. I learned about a thing called prejudice. I understood what it is to be cut out of the crowd and being different, and being picked on and being a scapegoat. So my name is Stephen Tejada Lewis. Now, Tejada is a Japanese name. It goes back to the 14th century. And in that classroom out there, the Americans were telling me that I was responsible, me personally, was responsible for the bombing of Pearl Harbor and the destruction of the American Navy out there. 75% of the population out there is related to me through blood and marriage, so I could not quite understand that. I learned that being non-white, I couldn't have any affairs or any connections and be nice and have friends, especially if there were girls, because I wasn't white. I got jumped on the school playground by 7 guys. And I got in trouble for inciting a race riot. Now, so far, I haven't talked about drinking. And I haven't talked about using any of the substitutions. Because in my family, being 2 years old, drinking and using were a ceremonial part of our lives. But going to Germany, I learned to use those things. especially alcohol, was complete. It was abundant, and the gang I was running around with were German. Showed me the easy ways to take the beers off the open market, right there on the edge of the street. And it was on both sides of Berlin, because at the time the Berlin Wall hadn't gone up yet. That went up just before I left, and I got shot at for that one too. That's a different story. I started abusing alcohol. I started raiding the medical cabinets, because all my life until then, I'd been accepted, and there was no difference. Life was enjoyable. It was fun. It was great. It was one big party, except for going to school. But out there, I started escaping my own feelings. I became angry. I became embittered. I was part of my training and upbringing. They told me I had to learn about God. I learned about the Shinto and the Buddhism. Well, now we're going to do the Roman Catholic too. And there's a nice guy called Pope John at the time. I heard he was a good man. And then one day he died. He says, well, if the Catholic God lets good men die and let the bad men stay around, meaning the people who are picking on me, God does not belong in my life. And I said, a little kid's prayer, and says, God, if you're a God, you can take care of the rest of the people, because they probably need you, but I don't want you. I'll take care of myself, because I cannot trust you to look after my own interests and see to it that I have a long and happy life. Now, and this is at the age of 8. I've lived 100 years by this time. And I can't take it. And I started making vows to myself that I was going to get even, and I was going to get back at everybody who looked at me wrong, said a word to me crosswise, or hurt me in any other way. And in hurting me, that also included hurting people in my family. I withdrew from society. I went to school because it was required, not because I wanted to, and not because learning was any fun anymore. I was forced to go. The only good thing about it was the Christmas party at a club that was elsewhere. And I got stinking drunk at the party and missed the bus and ended up having to walk back to the apartment through all the snow, about as high as this podium. I'm a lot shorter at that time. I'm drunk, I'm dizzy, I don't know what's going on with me. And I wandered all over the streets of Berlin until I found where the school was. And then I walked from there to the house and the apartment complex. The club, people, was only 3 blocks away from where I lived. It didn't matter to me. I was already indifferent to life. The only thing that kept me going was the resolve that I came out here with my family because I told my grandparents that I would take care of them. I would maintain the family unity and help maintain some of these vague notions of the traditions that held our family back together for all these generations. And I started forgetting about keeping those things. And I declared a vendetta against the rest of the world. I was going to get you before you got me. But still somewhere inside of me there was something saying that, Steve, you know, that's not right. You know, this is not you. and that drinking and that using, starting last year, I found to be a very effective gag on that voice deep inside of me. See, I got tired of telling myself to shut up. But this type of escape was good. It got me out of life, and it got me out of remembering and thinking and having to deal with everybody and anybody. And that's when I started becoming my own worst enemy. I started becoming the people that oppressed me. We came to California, and I was still getting into that same type of trouble. Relationships and getting together with people was not something for Steve. The Steve you see is different. Steve is out of place. He doesn't belong. And especially, he talks funny. See, in Germany, I learned how to speak very good English. And when I came out here, I learned that my English has a British Cockney accent with a trace of a German in it, because I learned it from a Bavarian innkeeper's wife. When I came here, I started being called other nasty names. Mexican, spick, or heaven forbid, I'm a dirty, stinking, rotten Indian. And inside, trying to maintain my identity, I'm not American, I'm not Spanish, I'm not Mexican, I'm not a spick, and I'm not no Indian. I am Hawaiian national. And this still kept me going. I was going to building up this anger and this rage and this bitterness. I was going through schools in Monterey, through their school system, and graduated from their Seaside High School during the civil rights movements, race riots, on-campus bomb threats. Weekends were good. It was parties. The weeks of going to school were even better. And we made deals for all that other paraphernalia, illegal drugs, right there on campus. And sometimes we never sat in class. Getting into fights with other people, because Steve doesn't think the way other people do. Stephen does not do the white man's thing. Stephen is strange. Stephen is weird. And you don't want nothing to do with Steve. Unless, of course, you want to know where the party's at and who's carrying what and how much it costs. I started making a killing out of debt. I always got a cut of the action. I always got a cut of the profit. I started getting into the shady side of life, where you're no longer talking about dollars and cents and favors. You're talking about markers. And if you don't know what a marker is, thank God you haven't gone that far. But my weakness still was women. Especially if her name is Candy. I like Candy. Or Sue, or Mary, or Sandy. Sarah. Michelle. See, I was thinking about wives who were going to be in my harem by the time I got out. I was thinking about the ultimate escape. A two-masted schooner with an all-girl crew. And we'd stop at all the finest ports in the world. This is without a job, without a penny in my pocket. The girls will take care of that for me instead. I was going to be that Mr. Cool. that man of mystery that you see in the movies. Nobody knows who he is or what he is. But you look for him. That didn't work. I started working at a McDonald's, trying to go to school. I totaled up a Ford station wagon with a 390 engine one morning because I spent all night and all week doing an all-night party between classes. Come to think that I didn't go to class. I just drank, I used, and I went to work in order to foot the bill for it. I should have died there at that accident. That 390 engine was wrapped around a telephone pole that was meant for me. The roof of that thing was sitting below the car seat. But I'm not staying in the hospital, because I don't trust doctors either. Later on, I started working at a restaurant as a dishwasher, closing up the place. And while the bartender is sitting in the office counting out the money, I'm sitting behind the bar, counting how many glasses I was going to be able to drink before he got done. And it usually took him a half hour, and I would drink the equivalent of half a case of beer. And I'd take a half a case of beer with me when it's time to leave, and I'd drink it on the way home. I kept this thing up until I came of age to drink legally. Now I started doing it even on the streets. I ended up walking around the streets of Monterey, drunk and loaded. I stopped off at the skating rink because I was supposed to meet some friends of mine there. They took me home, my folks took me to the hospital, and the doctors there said, "Mr. Lewis, Mrs. Lewis, your son has a very high alcohol blood count. Did you know he drank?" My mother, being such a sweet woman she is, says, "Well, we knew he drank, but we didn't know he drank that much. And did you know, Mr. and Mrs. Lewis, that your son had enough residue barbiturates in his system to kill 3 full-grown adult males?" At the time, I was 5'7", weighed 120 pounds. If I wore a sweatsuit that was dripping wet. These times that I was getting into these accidents, I always thought that, hey, this is the time I can finally check out. This is the time I can give up the fight, relax, and grasp and unfold oblivion. It didn't work. Doctor signing the death certificate, and I'm asking, "What's he doing?" I met a nice girl, and we went out. Me, her, and all her girlfriends. We got stopped by one of the local police down at the beach. Because did you know it was past curfew? I met another girl. I didn't like her. So I introduced her to a friend of mine. And a friend that at this time was defined for me was someone who could run with me in the streets, you know, creeping down Main Street looking at seeing who you can pick up for the night, or maybe even, if you're real lucky, have a long-term relationship, 3 nights. I didn't like her, but I liked her visiting cousin. And that's how I ended up being in the service. I joined the Coast Guard on the buddy plan. Well, it's good in the time as any for someone who is totally indifferent and sick and tired of living around here. There's nothing to do. The all-night parties aren't doing much for me. Work holds no interest. and what schooling I do have, it was amazing that I even made it through any one of those classes. So I joined the service with a totally indifferent attitude, full of anger, full of bitterness. Got stationed in Alaska, of all places, where it's cold. I mean, real cold. Heat wave was, when it came out, 53, 54, 55 degrees in a row. And I'm over here learning how to wear long johns, two pairs of jeans, five shirts, and two sweaters, besides a jacket. I was so withdrawn, I'd sit in the bars by myself before anybody else got there. I'd have a cup of coffee, a beer, and a mixed drink. They changed my coffee every time it got cold. My alcohol was cold anyway, and they had to replace that thing a lot faster because I drank those things up a lot. And someone up there was the first time someone mentioned AA to me. And I said, Steve, do you... But they didn't call me Steve. They called me Papa Louie. Nobody up there knew who I was. Not even the guys on the ship knew what my first name was. And someone up there says, Papa Louie, do you think you have a drinking problem? You know, there's a group called AA around up here. But maybe you ought to check them out. Says, oh, no. I don't have a drinking problem. There's never enough for me to drink. There is never enough ways. This is what I'm talking about in my own head. There are never enough ways for me to get away from everything and forget that I'm here. I was told that I was going to get transferred. I was going to go to a school out in Virginia. So the night I got that news, I was out in town celebrating. And we took it out into the woods around a bonfire. And I'm so drunk and I'm so loaded. And I don't care. I'm standing right in the middle of the bonfire trying to stay warm and keep my alcohol cold. Now that took some doing. I got back to the ship about 3:30 in the morning, drinking a six pack, smoking a number with someone else that was on board ship. And 4:30 we had a call and we had to go and save some people who got caught on some rocks out in the middle of the Gulf of Alaska. I'm over here trying to function as part of a rescue team. I'm not sure about what I was doing. All I know is that I was supposed to be here, I was supposed to be there, and I was supposed to do this, and I was supposed to do that. But the people on that fishing boat, I knew. These were drinking buddies of mine from in town. The boat sank less than 60 seconds with all of us on it. It almost took me down with it, but it didn't. Because I'm still here. I had a bad case of hypothermia. I was getting second-degree burns, taking cold showers. We got back into port, and the first thing I did was go to the drinking well. And I was getting drinks left and right from everybody else. Going to school out in Virginia, I was still drinking. That's how we studied. And on a military base, being a student there, you couldn't even have an empty beer can in your room. We had a whole liquor locker. You name it, we had it. Including the limes and the salt shakers. This is how I did my studying. And most of it was drinking alone. Partying was good, but I always ended up walking away from it. Because Steve is different. And Steve can't relate to these people. So you can figure out what type of a shock it is when my next order says, I'm going to be stationed in Natchez, Mississippi. 80% black, 20% white, and I'm neither one. I have trouble getting my booze at nightclubs and bars down there because they couldn't quite figure out which side of this fence I belonged. So I drink a lot more at home by myself until I passed out. Then I wake up in the morning and grab another beer just so I have enough strength to get up and brush my teeth and go to work. None of it was pretty, none of it was fun. But it was a way to make me numb and indifferent. I finally signed up again and spent another 6 years in the service. They paid me and they begged me to sign up and were going to send me to Honolulu for 6 years. Now, I always wanted to go back home and Uncle Sam was going to pay for it. And the weary warrior was going to go home, lick his wounds, maybe do something about the scars. Drinking. What is that? Says, well, that's where he tried drinking just a little bit and putting it down. Says, well, that doesn't sound like an idea that I can cover. But I'll give it a try anyway. From $150 a night, 7 nights a week, on an E2's pay. Now you figure that one out. I went to $50 a week. Now I'm damned. That which is keeping me numb so I can function with the rest of you, I'm over here cutting it out of my life this much, and it's not working for me to be half and half. I walked into work the next morning. It was October 5th, 1981. And I told my drinking buddy, who was my immediate supervisor, you know, I think maybe I might have some problems with alcohol, but I'm not too sure. Well, we'll check that thing right out. He made a few phone calls. That afternoon, I had to see a doctor for an examination. He says, and you come back tomorrow to finish up the rest of it. I go back on Tuesday, and he says, you also have an interview at this place on the Pearl Harbor Navy base. This is their dry dock. And you talk to the supervisor over there. He gave me this ream of paper to fill out. It was questionnaires. How much do you drink? Oh, about 6 a week. Do you drink alone? Doesn't everybody, when everybody else is asleep? Does alcohol occupy most of your life, your thinking? Not really. The other half of the time, I'm thinking of vendetta. I get done with all this paperwork. I'm sitting over here and is right across from their E Club, waiting for this interview so I can go across the street. It's getting to be lunchtime, and they have a meeting over there, and I'm not going to go there. They invited me to go to a brown bag AA meeting. Oh, no, that's for those sick people that really need it. It's hot. I'm feeling dry. I'm waiting for this director of this treatment center, to interview me. When he finally got the time, all he did was look at all the paperwork, you know. He looks out the door at me and says, "You're Steve?" I says, "Yeah." Waves his hand at me and says, "We'll see you here Friday noon." "Friday noon? For what?" I says, "That's when your treatment class begins. The orders will be cut." And they sent me to this treatment center. And I'm not an alcoholic, and I don't know why I should be over here in a military dry dock learning about not living without alcohol, because it's not for me. It's for those sick people. You know, they come from Wisconsin, Texas, Florida, California, Alaska, you know, the white whites, the black whites, the red whites, the yellow whites, all these Americans. It's for them. But because I'm home, they're reminding me about my responsibilities. Maybe if I stick around long enough, I might learn something that'll help you guys be a little more understanding about yourselves and wonder why I don't like you at all. And you too will see things my way, and you'll be on the winning side. You'll be bright and intelligent, just like me. And they forced us to go to AA meetings on the outside. And there's a group out there called the Nalia Group. And there's a gentleman there by the name of Harry Lake. He's one of the pillars of my sobriety. He says, "Welcome, brother. It is good to have you home." He shook my hand, he gave me a hug, and he says, you know, and a guy giving me a hug is something unusual, to say the very least. "Why don't you meet some other brothers here? Richard. Now, Big Richard is Hawaiian. He has just lost almost 100 pounds on a diet, and so now his weight is just under 300 pounds, 6'2". He says, "Richard, look, this is Steve, our new brother. How are you doing, brother? Good to see you." And he picked me up like a teddy bear and gave me a hug. Puts me down a little bit. "Francis, come over here, we have a new brother." Francis is Hawaiian Samoan, who's just about a fraction of an inch smaller than him and about 50 pounds lighter. And they put me in what we call a squeeze play. You know, it's just like belly butting, only I'm stuck in the middle. There's a big Hawaiian here, there's a big Hawaiian here, and here's little old me caught right between the two of them. "Because we love you and we want you around." "Whoa! You sure these are my people?" But they were. "We love you, Steve. We want you to stay. Keep coming back. Give yourself a trance. Put your misery outside the door there on the table. Read the book. Go to meetings. Talk to other people. Guys work with guys. Girls work with girls." One person says, "Learn to love the guys and just like the girls." That didn't quite work for me either. But I went. because I was in the treatment center. And you tell me things like, God loves you. I have one girl who has called herself a self-declared witch. Says, you know, Steve, God forgives you. He forgives you everything that you have done. Do you forgive yourself? This is the time I would go to a meeting, standing room only, and I'd have a 10-foot radius around me because people would not come near me. And I liked it that way. And I also wondered why even the people that I know from the islands, and one of them was a drinking buddy back when I was a kid, weren't coming around and staying with me and all pulling my side. And they told me things like, alcohol is an equal opportunity disease. It don't care where you come from, how white you are, how old you are, it'll knock you down. It will kill you. They gave me this book, and I still have it. And I have held it up, and it says, read this book, the first 164 pages. It talks about the program of recovery. Now, these people talk my language. So, you know how to write this word alcoholics? What does it mean? I don't know. A life centered on helping others live in complete sobriety. Well, what's that mean? You got a dictionary? Find out what sobriety means. It means being in the right frame of mind to make the right type of choices. The Malia group believes in service. Sobriety begins with service. And they met at an auditorium a little bigger than this. And they were giving me a 3-string mop. They said, you get to mop the back half of this thing after the meeting. Wait a minute. A man of my stature does not do menial work. Steve, you got a car? Says, yeah. Says, go to the other side of the island and pick up these people and bring them here for the meeting. You got 15 minutes to make this 20-minute run. Steve, who's your sponsor? I don't know. What's the sponsor? Says, well, this one are your sponsors until you learn how to pick one out for yourself. And if you have any questions, you also talk to Big Richard, Francis, Harry, or everybody else here. Now, Malia's sponsorship is very strange. I don't know if you have that type of sponsorship out here. In fact, I know you don't. They have the type of sponsorship that goes along the family system. Your sponsor is not working with you. Is not getting you involved in service. The people that he is running with, because they said run with a pack of winners, also have to get on his case and get on your case, because you are not reading the book, working the steps, going to meetings, getting into service. Not only does he and his pack pick on you, but their sponsors get down on them. And they get down on you. And they said things that I could deal with, like, you don't have to like your sponsor. In fact, it's highly recommended. You find someone who's got what you want, or you think you might want, and ask them to be your sponsor. I picked a white guy, because I didn't want Big Richard to be my sponsor. Well, you know how that backfires? Harry Lake is Big Richard's sponsor. Big Richard is the sponsor that I picked. And Big Richard and Harry Lake are the sponsors that were appointed to me. Now, I can't win for lose. know what it's like being the only abandoned child with all these mothers around you? They kept me up at 5 o'clock in the morning after meetings. Coffee and talk and good times. And remind me about my responsibilities to society that, don't forget, you have to be at work at 6:30, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. And as soon as you're done with work, swing by central office and pick up some literature. See what they have for you to do there. They would call me at home. And I said, you never forget about a meeting. 52 days, 7 days in a week, 52 weeks in a year. You pick the day out of the week that you've never been drunk, never been loaded, and that's the day you are excused from going to a meeting. Does that mean I got to go every day? Yeah, bro. Because we love you, we expect to see you there. And if I didn't show up or I had work, my phone rang. Steve, we missed you last night. Where were you? Which meeting did you go to? Seems like you didn't come to this one. Oh, okay. They checked up on me, I thought. I was pretty sure of it. 9 months into my program to get me into correctionals. One more thing is there, too. The prison that was holding me in was the one here between my ears. And it cut me off from the Spirit of God, who loves me anyway. He has nothing but the best for me. That's why he gave me you. Because man is a herd animal and he's not meant to be alone. He gave you me. And these walls that I put up, the warden, which is me, is the one that's been blocking me from it all this time. I had a white guy tell me, he said, Steve, you're not made of the stuff. Stick around in this program long enough. One person calls me flat out and says, you ain't got the guts. And a third one says, you'll never make it. So if you're new and you hear that sort of stuff, you can do what I did. I caught some resentment. And I was going to prove him wrong. And when that first year rolled around, there was an international group that we had a birthday meeting. And I had to tell them, like I'm telling you today, Steve did not make it. He died somewhere along the way. Steve did not have the guts to make this program or live life on life's terms. Steve does not have the guts to live. But my home group loved me enough till I learned how to love myself. But yes, I am powerless. And no, I'm not at a Burger King having it my way. But yes, I'm insane. But God, you put me into order. And that I have a God in my life who works with me when I work with him. I ate crow then. I told him these things. This is great. Welcome to life. This is reality. And I got right into another relationship. She didn't like what she had. She had me, so she left. Another girl came in, and she was willing to give up everything to stay with me. But by this time, I'm a little smart and says, that means I got to take care of her too. And she's got two kids. And one of those kids is a girl who has a baby, and they live in Alaska. And I couldn't do it. See, they ingrained with me the principle, the spiritual principles to live my life. I had to find out who I am. Who is Steve? and then I would be able to give you the best that is here, which is of the spirit of the God of my understanding. I end up in Ohio to finish the last few weeks of my service in the military. Over there, I end up with a kid who came up to me, you know, says, of all things, I says, Steve, you know, I don't have a dad. Will you be my dad? Now, I'm a person who didn't like whites, especially for Americans. And I want nothing to do with you. See, I'm a person that our mothers warned us about. And if any of us had any sense, we'd have nothing to do with either. Not even if we were dead. See, these sort of things touched me. Where I live, and where I was taking the risk of reaching out to other people. And says, it isn't Steve that he was looking at. He was looking at the God of my understanding that I got into contact with in these rooms, talking with other alcoholics who are just like me, irregardless, boy, girl, man, woman, race, creed, that we are all children of God, and that we are here by our Father's grace to enjoy this wonderful world, this wonderful playground, and wonderful playmates, to live life and celebrate the exuberance of the moment that we can share it now and be real. That when I am here, this is what you got. You know what the bill of goods are. That's because I did that four-step inventory, and I still do, to get rid of the wreckage of that old personality who occasionally still rises up again, angry and bitter. Harry Lake told me once, says that, do not put me on a pedestal. So I don't. And I don't put anybody else on a pedestal. This is because we're just one drunk talking to another drunk. And if you put anybody else on a pedestal, they're going to fall down, they're going to fall down hard, and they're going to take a whole lot of you with them. That's the way I understand it too. We are brothers and sisters. We are all sons and daughters of life. And we're here to enjoy it and share our discoveries about it. Problems still plague my life, but my attitude towards them changed. I can go to sleep without a job, without worrying how the bill is going to be paid, because the opportunity to take care of it will arise and it will resolve itself. And people do come into my life, and that's the most wonderful thing that I have. That spiritual awakening and a spiritual family that actually believes in Steve and loves Steve, and Steve can love them back just the way they are, and it's all right. I want to thank you for 12-stepping me tonight, and I'm not even sure what I talked about, but seeing the face of the people here, I know why they told me. Some people are sicker than others, and I'm looking at the mirror because I'm standing in the front of you. Thank you.